Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Let's face it, the future is now. We're living in a connected cyber society, and we need to stop ignoring it or pretending that it's not affecting us. Join us as we explore how humanity arrived at this current state of digital reality and what it means to live amongst so much technology and data. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com.
And we're live. Well, actually, we're not live. We're recording. So if you're watching this, it's already happened. So this is Marco Cipelli with Redefining Society podcast on ITSP Magazine. Today, again, same disclaimer. If you're listening to this, there is a video version. If you're watching this and you want to listen to this later on in the car, you can do that because it's going to be a podcast version as well. And there'll be everything in the note. Not me alone. That's boring, as I always say. I have a great guest today, Gary Guzenov. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly. If not, it's because I'm Italian, so sorry, I get away with a murder. But happy to have you on the show. Tell me a little bit about yourself, and then we're going to dig into what we are planning to talk about today.
Sure.
Redefining society.
Yeah, Marco, thanks for having me on the show. I'm happy to be here. I've been in the cybersecurity space for over 20 years. I started a company called Cyber Defender in 2003. Prior to that, I was in the direct response of customer acquisition business. I had my own agency. I've also co-founded a few tech companies. One of them is an influencer marketing company that ultimately brought TikTok to the United States. And so I'm very familiar with customer acquisition. Marketing required over 1 billion consumers. I've managed about $5 to $10 billion of media and have done about $500 million of venture capital, private equity fundraising for my different ventures. I currently run a company called Real Defense. We're a Pasadena-based tech company. We provide cybersecurity, privacy, and optimization software and technology services to consumers directly. We also license our technology. We're in 33 countries. We are in 4,000 retail stores. We're partnered with Lenovo, Dell, some of the biggest PC manufacturers in the world. And we're the leading company in this category in terms of scale. We have millions of subscribers and very profitable and growing, raised about $15 million in working capital over the past 5 years.
That's a lot. It's good.
It is.
Good stuff. So you've been in this industry for a while, and that's a good thing. I mean, I always think 14, 10, 20 years in this industry, it's centuries of culture. Yeah. If you look back in history, like, you know, sometimes we have conversation. We've been doing this ITSP Magazine thing for 8 years. And I look back at 5 years, I'm like, wow, things have changed. But you know what isn't change is I feel there's still that the need for education for consumers. And I think today we're going to dig into that. I mean, I'm sure you can talk about heavy cybersecurity, but that's not that channel. That's my partner, Sean, that talk about more cybersecurity. In this case, it's more for me the relationship between security, technology, which always come together. You can't really divide it, and our daily life and mass media and social media and all of that. So I like maybe to start with a look back at what you have learned and what you've seen change into how things have become better, worse for consumers and their knowledge and about cybersecurity, privacy, and the way they interact with all of this.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was always concerned about privacy more than I was concerned about cybersecurity, and this is as in comparison to, if you compare the two. And you have to look at cybersecurity from just a sort of general understanding that you have to block and tackle threats at all times. So there's viruses, malware, there's Trojans, all kinds of attacks that happen on devices all the time. And those attacks have to be blocked and tackled. So that's obvious. And you have to have, it's like having a bumper in your car or a seatbelt. You have to have it. The privacy area is very ambiguous. It's unpredictable. It's unknown. It's undefined for many reasons. It's not defined as a category in terms of when you say privacy, do you mean your physical privacy? Do you mean your photos? Do you mean videos? Do you mean YouTube? Do you mean your geolocation? Do you mean when you're walking into Starbucks and Starbucks tracks your, goings and your what you've purchased? Is that part of privacy? Where does it start? Where does it end? There's no definition. So the opportunity, I think, comes down to understanding what your risks are as a consumer, focusing on what you can control and not focusing on what you can't control. Not expect technology companies that are not in the business of privacy, like social media networks and others, expect them to protect your privacy. That's not their business. They're not there to protect your privacy. They're there to exploit information.
And right, I was going to go there.
Well, yeah, they're making money off of your behavior. They're not trying to hurt you. They're not trying to make your life miserable. That's not their intent. But you have to understand what's happening. And so once you do understand what's happening, then you should take appropriate steps. And so I'm happy to discuss the spectrum of what that is. And hopefully, consumers anyone who's listening to this can make their own decisions based on how much they want to, exploit themselves and or not. And so the spectrum is really wide.
Yeah, of course, we can talk about a million things, but what I want to talk about is what I'm kind of familiar with being, coming from years of branding and advertising and marketing and been doing that old school when I started, before the commercial internet, really, and the commercial internet and the come of social media. So I think you're kind of already touching on that and exploiting privacy, because at this point, a lot of people say, if you're not the client, you're the product. So if you don't pay for something, you're still paying for something, right, with something. And for me, it comes to, do you know or you don't know? Have you been tricked into, hey, this is free, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do with all your data? Or here's where you can do. You can pay and get the ads. You can pay or not pay and give me your data. How do you feel about that? I mean, you said you've been into this media buying industry. How has this evolved, and how do you feel about that from an ethical perspective?
I have a lot of opinion about that. So I understand both sides of it. I understand the advertising side. I understand how advertising tech works. I've built my own technologies around that. I also understand the risk for the consumer. I think the problem starts with disclosure and explicit sort of communication that doesn't exist in the relationship between the advertiser and the consumer. And it's been ambiguous over the years, and it's become even more ambiguous now. And advertisers, ad networks and various advertisers, don't necessarily control the interaction between their product and the consumer online, because of third-party networks and technologies like browsers and devices that are standing between the advertiser and the consumer. So there's a lot of sort of dependency on these other players, these third parties, to deliver the right message, to communicate disclosure properly, to deal with that information the way that they said they're going to deal with it. And so there's a big delta there. more importantly is that the laws that have been enacted, so GDPR and all kinds of other laws in the United States and in Europe to protect the consumer, address one layer of this problem, right? They're saying, well, if you're going to collect, you know, first name, last name, and email address of someone, you have to maintain certain disclosures, you have to, you know, let them opt out, etc. Where the advertisers are moving towards is fingerprinting, digital fingerprinting, where they don't need to know who you are. They don't need to know your name, your IP address. It's all being recorded in form of a digital profile that can travel with you anywhere you go. So you can be 10 steps away from the actual transaction process and still know who that person is, regardless of their IP address, their even their name or anything demographically or psychographically associated with them. And so that fingerprinting comes in lots of different flavors. It's how you type, it's websites you visit, it's your digital footprint that's unique to you. It cannot be duplicated by anyone. When you add artificial intelligence on top of this, it becomes impossible to block, because anything you do online becomes very clearly identifiable, okay? And so in the the government uses this tech to track bad people, right? That's been going on for a long time. And we know that, and I think that's totally okay, because you have to have this layer of sophistication where you're blocking against terrorist attacks or some sort of, you know, behavior that could, you know, hurt people. But when it comes to practical living, you know, someone buying an insurance policy and buying a car or whatever, that information needs to be mitigated. And so when you start interacting with digital devices, every one of your steps that you take, whether it's downloading an app or doing something within that app, it's all recorded, it's all tracked. It's not done to hurt you, it's just done as a matter of process. This is what these companies do. And so a practical sort of solution is, don't give up information if you don't have to give it up, okay? Just don't give it to anyone. If you're going to give up information and you don't know this other entity, this party, this app, this company, this website, don't give them real information. You can give hypothetical information that you can later retract or not use, so that they can't use it, against you. The other one is separate yourself from being digitally identified. So use special tools that obfuscate digital fingerprinting. In other words, tools that make it seem as if the company that wants that information is getting it, but in fact, they're getting inaccurate information. So you're basically creating like a smoke screen around yourself. There's tools to do that. Put a VPN on your device. So if you are traveling or you're at home and you want your IP to be obfuscated for certain transactions or certain websites or certain apps, then use a VPN. There are lots of benefits to using these types of tools. And so you have to be aware that those risks are out there and that you need to take precautionary steps. Not every time you connect to the internet, not at every app that you use, but in some instances you should use these technologies to protect yourself.
So it sounds to me, and I understand that of course it's up to the user in right. certain circumstances, but there is the GDPR, you know, there is the California Protection Act and many others, which, to be honest, it's kind of a pain. So I'm going to get to convenience versus security, right? Convenience versus paying the price for it. So it's all great. I'm in the cybersecurity field. I'm, you know, going to be at RSA pretty soon in San Francisco. I hear the stories. And I think about the everyday user. And, you know, I'm not a cybersecurity expert per se, but I'm in the, you know, I talk about it quite a bit from a society perspective. And then I think about, I don't know, my friends or my dad or my wife or whatever it is. I'm like, even if I say use a 2FA, two-factor authentication, I can see the eyes roll all the way back in the head. Right. And it's like, damn, now, you know, or password manager. I mean, we've talked about this thing for a long time, but is there, on your opinion, a different approach that could change things? I mean, do you see like regulation to be? And the other question is too, is once your personal information are out of the bag, can you put it back in the bag? Like, you know, for, you know, right to be forgotten. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of it.
it's difficult to answer that. So I'll do my best. I think the technology companies have a duty and a responsibility to be good actors, right? In this theater, right? They have to do the right thing at the end of the day. And so what they don't do very well is they don't, and this is actually kind of consistent across the board with all tech. They don't think of cybersecurity as a component of their development process, right? So when they sit down and say, let's build an app, dating app, what have you, cybersecurity or security, whether it's privacy or physical security or virtual security, doesn't come into their mind. They don't think of it as a must have. They think of it as a good to have and also a reaction to something bad happening. So let's take dating, online dating, for example, right? There are lots of problems in the online dating world, fake profiles, scams, people who don't, you know, are not who they say they are, fake pictures, you know, what have you. There's all kinds of problems, right? The companies who develop these apps didn't think about those things before they made those apps. They should have, because that's a natural sort of evolution of the problem, right? If you're going to create these virtual environments, there's going to be scams. So they react to them when the bad something, someone gets hurt, someone gets killed, someone complains, then they improve and then they iterate. Why don't we have the same requirements we have for the automotive industry or the pharmaceutical industry, for the tech industry? If you build a car, you can't sell it to consumers until Department of Transportation says that bumper works. Those seat belts are there for a reason. The engine is supposed to be this size and the car width needs to be this. If those guardrails are not there, you're going to have cars made out of cardboard and running on nuclear fusion around the streets because no one is paying attention to the rules. That's what we have. That's what's going on with the tech world. There are no guardrails. And so the government at some point in the late 90s or 2000 had the Section 230 enacted, which gave basically carte blanche to every tech company to do whatever they want with the data they collect and the data they utilize for their websites or their apps and then different digital environments. And so since then, there hasn't been any changes to it. But Section 230 is a horrible law. It needs to be changed and updated to, you know, conform to modern standards.
Can you explain it for the audience that may not know? I mean, of course, not the entire law, but kind of like the gist of it and why it is a problem.
Yeah, it's relatively simple. It basically says that if you are someone like a social media company and someone posts content on your network, that content is not the responsibility of the social network.
Because they're not the one producing that content.
Because they're not the one producing it. Yeah. It's the same concept of a telephone. You know, are you responsible for the conversation that takes place on the phone? Is the phone company responsible? And that's their logic. The difference is that the conversation that happens on the phone is not public information. But the content that is delivered online can become public and is public and is indexed. Okay, so that argument doesn't work in today's world, and I think lawmakers are afraid or don't know how to change the law to address this concern, and more importantly, are pressured by the big tech companies not to change it, because if they do change this law, can you imagine what will happen to big companies like Facebook and others who live off of this? They live off of this content, and so. There are ways to mitigate this. I think that if you put the right disclosures in place, make them explicit, tell users what exactly is going to happen once they submit their information, what's not going to happen. If you need to do something with that data and share it, just ask. Tell the user and say, you know what? We're going to sell your first name, last name, and address to 50 companies, and they're going to pay us a lot of money. we're going to give you a small fraction of that payment. Do you agree? Yes or no? Yes, I agree. Guess what? Everybody gets paid. Everyone has an understanding of what's going to happen, and we move on with our day. But what happens is all this activity happens in the background without our knowledge. They can make money. Consumers don't make any money. And then later you find out that some broker had your information. You get upset and you start, you know, filing lawsuits and, you know, all that. And so I think there's a gap there between disclosure, opportunity to maybe even make some money for the consumer and mitigate that situation before it becomes a problem. So that's not there. I don't think it'll ever be there.
Well, you know, I know we're getting philosophical, which is my territory. I love that. You know, when we go into the people think and, you know, like just the definition of privacy, you started with that, you know, privacy now is not what privacy used to be. You know, right. It's kind of a joke, but, you know, it is. But I was reading the other day on, it wasn't even real. It was on NPR. There was a segment about how big stores, I'm not going to put names there, but imagine a lot of big chains that give you a card so you get a discount. You put your phone number in there, you get the discount. Right. Well, it doesn't stop there. It's not that they do it. They get your information of everything you buy just for their own sake and give you a better service. They sell it to third party, that they then sell it to third party. Then they re-aggregate the crap out of it, sorry for the word, and all of a sudden they know, I don't know, if somebody's pregnant, they know if how many people you have in the family, you got kids. I mean, crazy. And this is even without the internet. I mean, even right. Without computation and big data, this was done years and years ago. So it's right. Not a new system. And it's just amplified to the extreme when you do it online. You know, right. When the smiley company does it, it's okay because you get the recommendation that you want and you're okay with it. But do you really know what's going on in the back of that? But my question is, do you think people really care?
Well, some people care. I think that not everyone, but I think some people care. I think the question should be is whether or not, if you don't want your information to be tracked, you should have the ability to do that. You should be able to say to the company, I don't want to be tracked. And here, you know, I don't need to tell you why. I just don't want to be tracked for whatever reason. So I think that option should exist. And that option should not be, you know, it should not exist in some sort of a vacuum or, it should be easy for you to do so. And it currently isn't. The benefit of predictability, meaning whether it's artificial intelligence or big businesses, big tech companies, being able to kind of predict what you're going to do, there's a benefit to that. And in fact, the benefit is dramatic. If you, are being offered certain products at the right moment, if you're driving and you're being told where to go and to avoid traffic, if your life becomes better with predictability and artificial intelligence, then everybody wins because it's a good thing, right? But the minute you don't want that, the minute you don't want to be predicted, you don't want to be pitched, you should be able to say no. And that no does not exist in a vacuum. It needs to be clearly communicated to those parties involved. And maybe it's temporary, no. Maybe I don't want to be tracked for 2 days, and then I want to turn it back on again, right? It's not permanent. And so that mechanism of control doesn't exist. And so you have to be the warrior at the end of the day, utilizing these different technologies, knowing to turn them on or off and mitigate it yourself.
Which is crazy. Come on.
It's what it is.
I know. So talking about this, I'd like to touch, I don't know, we didn't talk about this before, but what you just mentioned, it makes me think about the promise of Web 3.0 and the whole encryption and all the thing that, you know, I'm going to turn it on when I need it to do this transaction. I'm going to take it back inside my wallet again, and you can't get my information anymore.
Right.
I'm asking this to different people, and some people are very excited about it. Some people say, yeah, it's kind of marketing pitch. How do you feel about this? Do you think it could actually happen that all of a sudden we switch something and we have a better system?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen like that quickly. The idea behind virtual reality, first of all, virtual reality has been here for a long time. And I don't know if you remember the virtual reality markup language, VRML. It was a HTML alternative that basically allowed you to write code in such a way where everything was a virtual reality. There was special browser plugins for it. This is Netscape days. This is 15 years old or maybe even more. And it never took off because it required a lot of computing power. And so for virtual reality, Web3 to actually work in the way it's intended to work, we don't have the computing power today to do it. We don't have the chips. We don't have the internet speed. So that's one of the biggest sort of stumbling blocks we're going to be coming across over the next 5-10 years. The bigger issue is utility of this technology, right? So do we want to use virtual reality as a replacement to other tech, which is what...
And I was talking about more than that to the encryption. So, you know, I was talking about the whole encryption and, you know, the like kind of like the cryptocurrency and the whole system like that. So virtual reality is another thing, of course, but I was referring to retaining in the crypto chain your individuality and not sharing it with everybody.
Right. So one of the problems that Web3 is trying to solve is the virtualization of communication streams. So right now, when you have SMS, email, you have all these different ways, social media accounts, you have to maintain different code bases, different security protocols for all those different streams of communication. Imagine if they all went away and the only thing you had was your virtual reality presence in the Web3 space. So think of it as an avatar.
Got it. Okay.
And right? So that avatar is now talking through all these different streams, email, web, the whole thing. And its security is really your digital identity that happens in Web3. So the security component is virtualized, and it's almost like a sandbox in the cloud. Like, it doesn't hit you on your device. It hits you in the cloud. So all those messages and everything else that goes there, that's much easier to control from a security standpoint than the machine that is currently getting hit with the threat. Because every machine has to be separately managed, separately secured, not the virtual environment. Virtual environment can be secured in real time, much faster than the endpoint device needs to be secured for zero-day attacks, all that. That's an ideal scenario, okay? Mm. Are we even close to that? No one has this technology. No one's talking about this technology. I don't know what Facebook is working on with tens of billions of dollars spent. Are they building video games? Are they building actual new world operating system, new world security environments, which is what we really need, not more video games. And so I think we're far away from this. It's all hypothetical. And yes, it'd be great if your identity is presented in this virtual form. And the blockchain, or maybe some derivative of blockchains, I'm not a big fan of blockchains. I don't think it's sophisticated. I think it's old tech. There's other ways to do this. You don't need a blockchain to track information. I think it's a waste of energy because you're tracking information that's inconsequential. There are other better tech out there to secure your virtual identity. But what would be interesting is if that virtual identity was first of all very secure, and second of all was an opportunity for you, meaning if your information is used in any way, you get paid. If your information is looked up a certain way, you know who's looking at it. You can control, turn off, turn on, right? And the advocates of cryptocurrency, their big pitch is you don't need a bank. You can just store your own money. We can't even keep our packages safe in front of our house from people who steal our, you know, Amazon boxes, right? Somehow we're going to be good stewards of cryptocurrency in a virtual environment. It sounds amazing, but it's not practical in today's world. It has to be really secure and stable for someone to take the position that banking isn't necessary, and I can maintain my own currency, my own digital identity, my own digital life in a virtual environment in a very secure form.
Yeah. It's and I get No, go ahead, finish.
No, I was going to say, hopefully we'll get there. I don't think we're anywhere near that point.
Yeah, I was going to say that. It's beautiful to think about that as the utopia, the ideal solution. But the reason why I ask you that, and I'm still thinking, all the walled gardens that we're dealing with every day, and now I understand why you went with the virtual reality, meaning your virtual digital twin persona, that's right. What you use. And you realize, as you just said, how complicated it is, because not only you have different languages, but you have, you know, you are a different password, you are different logins. You can't just log into Facebook and log in into another one with the same. I mean, they're trying to do that, you know, they're trying to say log with this, log with that, you know, but already you have, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 different competitors in that, and they're all trying to keep you in their own walled garden. And I kind of think about that when I think about the metaverse and people like, yeah, there is this metaverse and there is this metaverse. And I'm like, if you want to call it metaverse, it's one.
It's
like
one.
The moment I can go with my stuff from one to another, that's going to be the metaverse. Otherwise, you're giving me another platform. You know, it's not what I'm thinking, to be honest with you. And I think we went a little bit on the tangent here with that, but it does connect with this concept of privacy, which is where I want to end our conversation again. And I don't know if there is an answer, which many times during my conversation, there's not an answer. There is a lot of thinking, a lot of thoughts, a lot of if and maybe and what would be. But the reality is that right now, I don't think there is a solution that you just take it, apply it, and all of a sudden the whole internet and connective world is going to change.
I see the future where consumers are going to take extraordinary steps to protect their privacy. I think I see a future where privacy exploitation will reach levels that we haven't seen before, because it's extremely profitable and saves companies a lot of money by being very micro targeted on consumer behavior. It reduces the inefficiency of the advertising dollar, and inefficiency of the manufacturing process, inefficiency of human capital investment. And so if you look at all those areas of opportunity and you use artificial intelligence to reduce these costs, you're going to want to invest heavily into micro-targeting. And so I think we're just at the cusp of that, of the rise of that. On the consumer side, I think you're going to see clothing designers come up with products that obfuscate your facial, your visual of your face in such a way where cameras cannot detect your biometric, they identify you. I think you're going to see technologies that obfuscate your physical presence by giving away fake information so that beacons cannot pick up on your geolocation. I think you're going to see tools and software that obfuscates your metadata online so that it makes it seem like you're in one place when you're not, because you don't want to be robbed, or you don't want someone to know where you're actually currently present at, your friends or family, whatever, advertisers. And so I think we're going to see a lot of evolution going in separate directions. I don't think we're going to see kind of everyone come together and shake hands and say, here's how we're going to play nice in the sandbox. That's not going to happen. It's the opposite. And we're going to see consumers that are going to be very sophisticated, who are going to have very special tools equipped with hardware and software and special utilities that protect their identity on different levels. And businesses are going to get even more sophisticated to address this opportunity in terms of micro-targeting. It's happening already.
Yeah, I mean, I wish we had the answer for everything, and 42, maybe, you know, that's the magic number. But it's just the way we are, you know. It's social engineering. It's been done since the beginning of our societies. Now it's done different. It's exponential. I think like online has brought everything, you know. AI, I had conversation about AI and use for use it for phishing email, and it's like, yeah, you can have a targeted phishing email one-on-one done by an AI in fraction of a second, instead of having to send the same one to everyone and let's see who bites. I mean, it's gonna be difficult. So I don't want to scare anyone, but I also think that education is definitely that. And the answer again is maybe to go back to the social media and the bubble of information, and are they responsible or not? I think in the end, somebody's going to have to take some responsibility, because like you said, it's not about one single call. It's about you and thousands and hundred thousands and million of people are seeing that fake news, for example. Right. And somebody got to do something about it. Is going to be an AI? I don't know. But somebody's going to have to catch that thing. And I think companies are doing a lot. I think it's not in their interest to keep this going out of control.
I think that, you know, if you could put the future of blockchain on the map here in terms of how it could help, I think where it could help is on collective intelligence level. In other words, consumers creating their own network of intelligence that fights back on a collective level, not an individual level. And so individually, you can only spend so much on cybersecurity and privacy tools. I mean, let's say it's thousands of dollars a year, and that's very high. But if you are using collective thinking, collective, you know, reasoning, collective, you know, sort of security across the network, you can spend a lot more collectively and defend yourself against these types of threats. And so we are far, even further away from that. But once we have very high, you know, high-end chips that are, can be embedded into you know, our bodies, and we come closer to the singularity, and all those things are happening, you're going to see collective security as a sort of barrier to entry for anyone, for businesses or governments, what have you. I think we're somehow going to get there, you know, in the next, you know, maybe 20 to 30 years. But that's the best security you know, measurement that you can take is only when you have the masses, not individually or just your device.
The power of the crowd. You know, I like that concept of collective security. The idea of community coming together, either small businesses or cities that create that protection. I think it's great because it doesn't preclude globalization, but it does enforce the community again, which, you know, it's part of who we are. So Gary, I enjoyed this conversation. We went all over the places, but I think again, a show like this is successful, an episode like this, if makes people think. So I want people to think. I think there was a lot of interesting point that you made in terms of be on guard and take precaution, and most of all, understand what you're using as much as you can, given that nothing comes with a manual anymore, and probably we couldn't even understand half of that manual. But at least some disclaimers, I think it could be helpful. And until then, yeah, just do what you can, and stay tuned, because we'll have many more conversations like this on redefining society, because we do need to change and redefine ourselves as we go. And maybe not as fast as technology evolves, but, you know, we got to try to keep up. And the people like Gary that look at these things, do this business out of this and think about what the possible outcome will be, I think it's a good thing. So share it with your friends and family if you thought you got something out of that. Subscribe to Redefine Society podcast and ITSP magazine. And of course, in the notes, there'll be links to Gary, his company, what he does, and how to get in touch with him. So Gary, thank you so much. Great conversation.
Marco, thank you. Pleasure being here.
Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.